Blog Talk Radio.
If you believe you can move the highest mountains, cross the greatest oceans, walk across the water, the water. You feel defeated, falling on your knees and looking up for some hope tonight. You try to stand up, but you throw your hands up, like you no longer have the strength to fight. Cause you've seen too many sunsets, too many days ending in the darkest night. But on your own, you'll never know, you'll never know. If you believe you can move the highest mountain, cross the greatest ocean, walk across the water, the water. Believe you can move the highest mountain, cross the greatest ocean, walk across the water. If you believe.
They say that all you need is faith, but it's almost like you lost your way. Took a few wrong turns, took a few breaks, falling behind now looking for grace. Cause you need someone to lift you up, yeah, make right of the things you've done. Cause on your own you'll never know, you'll never know.
If you believe you can move the highest mountain, cross the greatest ocean, walk across the water, the water. Believe you can move the highest mountain, cross the greatest ocean, walk across the water. If you believe, if you believe,
you can do anything, you can do anything, you can do anything if you believe.
If you believe you can move the highest mountain, cross the greatest ocean, walk across the water, the water. Believe you can move the highest mountain, cross the greatest ocean, walk across the water. If you believe, yeah.
Good evening. Welcome to the Ask Sophia Show. Let's bring her on, the woman herself. Let's give her a round of applause.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Ask Sophia Show. My name's Sophia Giorgio, and I am delighted to have the wonderful Natalie Kairosh back for our second part of this amazing story. For those of you that heard Saturday's show, we talked about Natalie's experience and talked about lots of different things that we basically went through, the experience of her being attacked and stabbed and everything else. So it's just wonderful to have you back, Natalie, and I just wanted us to have an amazing evening this evening, because I know you've got so much to tell us about the things that you've been doing over the last few years and the amazing work that you've done. So welcome back. Welcome back. How are you?
Oh, thank you for having me, and good afternoon, everybody, and good evening over here in the UK. But yeah, I'm very good, thank you. Over in the UK, we have a lot of rain at the moment, so I am a little bit damp from taking the dog out for a long walk, but apart from that, we're all good.
Well, welcome back, and if it's okay with you, Natalie, because there are a few people that might not have been able to hear on Saturday, who might have not have tuned in on Saturday, do you mind giving a little bit of a recap on your story, if that's okay? And then we can sort of move on to all of the other amazing things that you've been doing. If that's okay with you, we'll start with that first.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to start out, for anyone listening, if you missed Saturday's show, first of all, shame on you. Where were you? Only joking. For those of you who missed Saturday, just to let you know, it is quite a hard story. So please do take care of yourself. basically 2016, I was 8 months pregnant and I was living a very happy, very secure life, a very good career in the full industry. I worked for one of the larger pharmaceutical companies, quite high up. And I was about to have my third baby with my partner, Bobby. And life all seemed good. And one Friday afternoon on March the 4th, 2016, I was about to start my maternity leave. I'm heavily pregnant, walking into my town centre, which is a very lovely area, quite an affluent, quite a rich area where people like footballers, things like that sort of live. I'm not that rich, by the way, hoping to be one day, but not quite there. But I'm walking along in my own little world and I'm jumped from behind. And it's just, how can I put it? It's that moment where you just think, how can this be happening? And I know for people who have life-changing moments where something really horrific and literally a world goes from being really lovely, safe and secure one moment to absolute utter destruction the next. So I'm grabbed by a man who's in heavy disguise. He pulls out a knife. He starts stabbing me. And when I say start stabbing me, it's a very ferocious attack. It lasted 9 minutes. And in those 9 minutes, I was stabbed 24 times. The police arrived on scene. They were faced with a horrific scene. Nobody expected me to survive. The whole area of the street is a murder scene. And they flew me out in a helicopter. An air ambulance helicopter flew me to the hospital. Nobody expected me or my baby to survive. We rushed into the operating theatre. They work on me for many hours. At one point, my heart did actually stop, which I recently learned. And I wake up the next day coming out of a coma to be surrounded by police and doctors telling me the amazing news my daughter survived. But even that was followed up very shortly with the news that she had been resuscitated, she had severe brain injury, that she was in a different hospital. So as a mother, I was absolutely distraught. And then I realised the police are there waiting to talk to me and they break the horrific, even to this day, I can't believe the moment when I think back to it, the horrific, horrific news that the person who'd stabbed me and the man who was heavily disguised was in fact my partner, Bobby, who I'd actually known for many years since my school days and the man who'd never been violent to me. So my world literally went from very happy, safe place to one I just didn't recognise within a matter of hours. And I was left fighting still for my own life, fighting my baby to help fight with her life and get her back to a place, but also dealing with a court case, coming to terms with what happened, learning horrific truths about my ex-partner and what he'd actually been getting up to, and a horrible life that I didn't know about. And you have that moment of sink or swim. You can give up, you can say, do you know what, I can't cope with this. And trust me, there were very dark moments at times. But I had three children, and Sophia, you know, I was never ever going to give in. Never. And I thought back, and what we're going to talk about this evening will be very much about the sort of things I've gone on to do. And I want people to really hear with tonight the sort of some of the topics we're going to discuss are going to be quite controversial at times, you know, quite tough topics that people don't like to talk about. But do you know what, we need to have those conversations.
No, do you know what, Natalie, the more controversial the better sometimes, I think, because I think one of the things for me specifically with this show is that I want to make sure that whatever we talk about, you know, we're able and guests are able to tell the truth and tell, you know, say it as it is. And some people will like it, some people won't. However, you know, I think it's something that we need to talk about. And we had a brief conversation this week, didn't we, when we were talking about what, you know, what we're going to do with this show. And I'm really keen to understand, because going back to the conversation that we had before we ended the show last on Saturday, we were talking about the legal system. And that's a really important thing that I think, especially here in the UK, I want to talk about your case, because you've told me so much about your case, which just blows me away, that I just can't believe, you know, these things happen and how the legal system here in the UK works. Do you mind sort of explaining the situation that you had with your with the legal system? Because it certainly didn't pan out how you would hopefully would have expected it with his sentencing, that's for sure. And I think people listening are going to find it quite surprising, to be honest, because I was completely and utterly blown away by what you told me. So, let's look at that. Let's have a conversation about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing people also need to remember when I sort of talk about this and take you through is put yourself in the position, you know, I was living a life which was utterly destroyed physically and emotionally. So as a victim, you're so in the hands of the legal system because you don't understand it. You know, it's not something that you learn about necessarily. You know, I knew everything there was about pharmaceutical products and I was very clever in that sense. But when it came to the legal system, the police, investigation, I had absolutely no idea. So you're there at their mercy. You think, well, they're going to do the very best for me. The police started the investigation. We went to a plea hearing and I insisted, first of all, that I was going to go to court. And that surprised the police quite a lot. They were like, okay, you're going to go to court. That's not usual for the victim to turn up for the plea hearing. This is where he's going to plead guilty or not guilty. And I said, I want to be there. I want to see him at that moment when he pleads. And we went in and he came in on a video link from the prison. And he was a man who came across as very calm, very in control, like he was on a conference call, like, you know, like a business conference call. He was making notes. And I was looking at him and it's very important to highlight this because actually this sort of contradicts totally the story that he told, which is a man who's of such despair and remorse. But at this point, he's very together and he asks for a deferral. He said, I can't remember what he'd said. It was something to do with the lawyer that he'd got, that they wanted some further investigations before he put in his plea. So I was very disappointed. They said, well, we will defer by another month. So I had to go away and build up to that day again. And it takes a lot, you know, the days before, you know, you're going to court, you're going to face him, you're going to see him, you're going to understand whether it's going to be a guilty or a not guilty plea and what that's going to mean. And I got to court again a month later and I sit there and he comes up on the screen again. They bring him on video link and again, he's very calm. And they read out the charges and very coldly they say, and how do you plead to the attempted murder of Natalie Kairosh? And he just said the words guilty. Very calm, very together, how do you plead to the attempted child destruction of her baby? Guilty. And he said he wants to make it clear that his intention that day was to kill Natalie. And it also is very matter-of-fact, and that I just broke. I was sat in tears, and I'm looking at him on this video screen thinking, you are so together with all of this. I don't recognise this man. This man is showing no remorse. He's showing no emotion. And I'm just looking at it like, right, okay, he's pleaded guilty to everything. He's also pleaded guilty to, it's called actual bodily harm, grievous bodily harm. So it's like a serious assault of two passers-by who tried to help. He pleaded guilty to carrying a knife in public. So he had five charges that he pleaded guilty for. So I'm sitting there thinking, okay, that's really hard to hear, but, you know, this means we're not going to have a trial. I'm not going to have to stand up and give evidence. And let's be honest, he was arrested on the scene by police standing over me with the knife covered in blood. I mean, it's so like obvious he had to plead
guilty.
So I'm sort of thinking, well, okay, yeah, that's confirmed. Right, so we set a sentencing date. So then you have to go away again. And it's like, well, when sentencing? Well, it's another month. And you're like, oh, my God, this is going on forever. You know, it's like, okay, come back in another month. Sit in court, and they bring him in. This time he actually comes in person. This is the first time I have physically seen him since the day of the attack and really seeing him in the face properly since he left home that morning. So that morning of the attempted murder, he was in bed as normal with me cuddling. So I'm looking now at this man thinking, the last time I saw you properly, we were lying in bed cuddled up together with you saying about how much you love me. And I cannot believe I am here 3 months later staring at you through a glass sheet. And he's sitting there and they do all this summing up and his family pays this really expensive lawyer, and this is where it all just was awful, because in the UK we have the Crown Prosecution Service, and they, the Crown Prosecution Service, are part of the government. They represent our justice system, and I had no input really as to what they were going to present. So whereas he, as a defendant, can talk to his lawyer and say, well, what are you going to present? How are you going to do the case? I don't have that. So even though they're prosecuting him, they're trying to kill me, I have no idea what's going to be said. That's very difficult. You know, you're thinking, hold on, why have I got no input into what you're actually going to say or present or what's going to be included?
Yeah.
So they go through the evidence, and his lawyer pulled every single trick in the book to minimise his sentence. He wrote a letter to the judge saying how remorseful he was. He pleaded the card that the pressure from his family, this is a grown man who's 41 years of age, saying the pressure from his mother, for God's sake, get a grip. What do you mean, the pressure from your mother? The pressure from his mother got so much that he temporarily had this adjustment disorder. He didn't plead insanity, adjustment disorder. And he didn't know quite what he was doing, although he had admitted he'd been planning it for 2 weeks. So that doesn't quite fit in, I'll be honest. And he had even said in evidence, I knew I shouldn't murder her, but I felt I had no other choice.
Oh my God.
Well, clearly you had lots of other choices. I'll be totally honest. I could write a list for you if you'd like. Mm. You know, let's write a list of other choices than murder. But how a wonderful man he was. And the judge comes to the summing up. This is the important part. You're kind of there, like the judge is now going to sum up and he's going to tell us what's going to happen. Right, this judge opens up and he says, right, Bobby, or Babu Roger, and I'm not saying anything, his name is in the public, I'm not repeating a name, that's the wrong thing to do. He said, Babu Roger, I see you as a very dangerous man. You went to work as normal that morning, which he did. You showed no signs of violence. You showed no signs of anger. And yet you carried this out in a very cold and controlled way. The injuries you inflicted on Natalie Kairos were very severe, so they were very targeted. So it wasn't a frenzied attack, as in I was cut all over. Everything hit all my major organs, so heart, lung, liver, you know, main arteries and wrist, everything was very targeted. So he said all this, and we thought, great, this is going to be, you know, he's going to get the sentence he deserves. He said, so I'm considering a life sentence. Brilliant. Now, in the UK, a life sentence does not mean that you're in for life, unfortunately, but it does mean that there's no definite time when you'll get relief from prison. And even when you do, you always have this sentence hanging over you. So if you do anything wrong, you're back to prison. So I'm sitting there going, right, at least it's a life sentence. Brilliant. Good starting place. However, you have got all these good references and you haven't really been ever in court before. So we're not going to go with the life sentence today. But we'll start at 30 years. So I was sitting there going, okay, 30 years, that's not bad. Okay, that's cool. However, you have pleaded guilty. Therefore, we are going to take a third off your sentence and give you the full tariff. Now, what that means is that when someone pleads guilty here in the UK, they can get up to a third off their sentence. Now, Bob was caught standing over me with the knife covered in blood, had no choice, by police officers, had no choice. They said, you pleaded guilty at the earliest convenience. Again, that's not true because we deferred the first plea hearing. He didn't plead guilty at the point because we had to have two plea hearings. So I sat there and you're not allowed to say anything. It's really frustrating. You're thinking, that's not true. That's not true. And you can't say it. You have to just sit there and hold everything in. And he said, so I'm going to take a third off. So now we're down to 20 years. My heart sank.
Wow.
Then he said, and then we have all these character references for you. So because you're of good character, excuse me, you do remember the really violent murder attempt that he did on me. As you're of good character, I'll take a further 2 years off. So you now only have to serve 18 years, of which you need to be in prison for a minimum of 12 years. And at 12 years, you'll be eligible for parole. I'll be honest, though, my heart just broke. I sat there. I could feel there's all the press, the UK national press, all the newspapers, television people, radio, and they were all staring at me. And I turned to the police officer and I just looked at him and I said, get me out of here. Please get me out of here. And I got escorted out of the courtroom very quickly. I was taken upstairs and I held it together and they shut the door And boy, I'll be honest, I exploded. I just went, what the hell just happened there? And the barrister came up and said, what happened? 12 years, minimum 12 years. He's going to walk out potentially in 12 years. And my baby is only 12 years old. And how am I going to ever keep her safe from him? How would I ever trust it? How would anyone be able to tell me that they're going to keep him away from my child? And they're like, yeah, it is. And then they go, well, it is lenient, but we have to prove it unduly lenient. So that means we have to prove that it's too lenient, that they were too soft, in effect, in the sentencing. And he said, and the problem is, if we do that, Natalie, he goes, you've got 6 weeks to decide. Brilliant. I'm really traumatized today. I'm not in the peace of mind to even think about it. He said, but if you decide to go ahead and appeal, you run the risk that his sentence might be shortened even further. Now, in my eyes, I'm really traumatized. I'm really vulnerable. I'm 3 months after the attempted murder. I'm still fit. I'd literally just had hand surgery. So I've got all my hands sort of bandaged. I was physically very ill, still, you know, mentally obviously not in a great place at all. And they're telling me, you've got 6 weeks to make this decision. And if you do that decision, you run the risk, by the way, that his sentence might get shorter. It was horrific.
I mean, it's just, listen, and this is why I have to speak up sometimes about things like this. And like I said, it can be quite controversial. But I think our British justice system, I know of other cases, and I'm not sort of casting aspersions here, but it's just shocking to me that something that is blatant, what would it have taken for them to actually give him, you know, a sentence that he deserved? Would he have had to have killed you? Do you understand what I'm trying to say? I mean, the fact is, that was his pure intention. He had been planning and premeditating this attack on you for a period of time. It wasn't as if he just flipped and then decided that he was going to kill you that day. He'd been pre-planning. He'd organized, like you said, the way that he was wearing layers and layers of clothing. He had his rucksack to change. He had all of these things. This is not something that somebody's going to do on a spur of the moment. So this man is, you know, pre-planning, and
I mean, he was talking to me on the phone. For those who don't remember, he was talking to me on the phone 20 minutes before he jumped me. He was calm. He told me he was stuck in traffic. His final words were, I love you. He sent an email, which I still have on my system. He sent an email half an hour before with those little kissing face emojis, saying how he'd paid for this pregnancy hypnobirthing yoga session. So he'd made sure that everything looked, that if people looked at my phone, if people looked at my emails, they would just see this loving relationship. So he went down to that much detail that half an hour before, he's getting changed, as you said, into a disguise where he wore multiple layers of clothing. He padded himself with a rucksack. The rucksack had spare shoes, spare clothes. He had a black bin bag in his back pocket. He had two pairs of gloves on, latex gloves, gardening gloves over the top. And they believed that it was this temporary adjustment disorder. I've always said, if he had actually, I know this sounds horrific, and I don't mean this to sound as horrific as it's going to come out, but if he'd gone crazy in the kitchen, we'd had a big argument, he grabbed a knife and he did it, that would be horrific. Not believing that would be horrific, but it would be easier to understand. What he did was so cold, so calculated, and then he gets away with that minimum 12 years. And I my heart is broken. I've come, you know, I look at lots of cases now that get sentenced here in the UK. And I work in a young adult prison that we'll talk about later, I'm sure. And I work in young adult prison. I work with lads who are gang members or former gang members and committed various crimes. And all of them have got a lot longer sentence. And you think, how is it? Is this because of money? Is this because it's domestic and it's not you because he was my partner? And is it somehow that skews it with some weird bias in there that because we were partners, would he have got charged more if he was a stranger to me?
If he was a stranger. Yeah,
who knows?
Absolutely. And I think, oh my God, I mean, it just makes me as an individual, and obviously it's different for me because I know you, Natalie, you're a friend of mine. But, you know, looking as a person, you know,
The call just dropped. Natalie, are you still there?
I'm still here. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, one second. The call. One second. I'm gonna play. I'm gonna try if we can get her back. Hold on one second.
I want your love.
sorry, everybody. What can I say? Technology. Technology and my producer. What can I say? Unfortunately, that was wasn't expected, but we're back. We are back. And let's start again where we left off, Natalie. I was talking, and I think I was ranting a little bit about the justice system and everything that you've had to go through. The fact that, obviously, you know, we were talking about his sentence was just, when you look at his sentence compared to other sentences for lesser crimes, it's just shocking. I mean, where do you stand, Natalie, with the fact that, you know, potentially in 5 years' time now, you know, he could be out of prison? Where does that leave you as the victim? Where does that leave you as the victim? You know.
Yeah, as I was saying, that's the thing that's really, really, really hard, because this is what people don't always consider. And I'll be honest, you know, that's no criticism, because I certainly probably never really thought about it in depth until I'm in the situation that every year. So his sentence goes from the day it happened, which obviously was the day that my daughter was born. So every year it's her birthday. We celebrate her birthday. It's a very happy occasion. At the same time, I get a lot of flashbacks and a lot of memories. But also every year, as I count up the years of her birth, so she's just had her seventh birthday this year, I'm also counting backwards. And I feel sick insofar as I know now that I'm over that halfway point to his minimum term, because we're 7 years in, his minimum term is 12. So in 5 years' time, I potentially am going to be sat on a parole board. I have asked to be present and you know, put sort of a case forward as to what impact it would have on me and my family and my daughter should he be released. But that's only one part of the parole system. You know, what they consider at parole board is this person safe to be released back in the community? They'll look at how they've been in prison. And I can guarantee that my ex would have been amazing in prison, because he was always very charming, very typical, almost like a psychopath. He's always a very charming person. They can be very manipulative. They will create a persona that they feel is acceptable to other people. And I'm sure that he has been doing all of that in his time inside. And he will therefore get to parole board. They will look and go, well, he's had a great record. He hasn't been in fights, because he wasn't the type to just get into a fight. He's done this, that, the other. Has he done his courses? So I don't know how much the weight of what I have to say will play. But equally, you know, there's so much to bring up insofar as when it got to the trial, you know, they didn't have half the facts that I've found out since, you know, about all the multiple lies, this sort of double, if not triple life that he was leading, and therefore how dangerous he is, you know, because that shows how manipulative he can be, that the fact that what he portrays is not the person that he actually acts to be. And, you know, that is not something that's just going to have changed from him sitting in a prison cell for 12 years. Because no course is going to change. I work, like I say, with young adult prisoners, and I work with young lads who, there's many reasons as to why they're sitting in the position that they're in. And you can work with them on that. It could be through trauma and neglect, and they've ended up in gangs and connecting with people they shouldn't have. But when you've got something like my ex, how can you work with that? It's like with any psychopath. There's something sometimes fundamentally you've got to go, well, can you ever say they're safe? Could you ever say, yes, this person could be safe, that they wouldn't do this again? Because there was no warning sign that Bob was going to do what he's doing. And so every year we get closer. It's horrible. It turns my stomach. It's something I think about. You know, honey, I think about it most days, and I've been really honest. I think about it most days. I think about that moment, even coming out. I can be in a fuel station, a gas station, filling up my car. I had this a few months ago, and a guy pulled up in his car next to me, and I glanced across, and he looked like Bobby, and my heart stopped, and I thought, Natalie, he's in prison. It's not him. Just calm down. And I could feel my heart racing. I felt sick. I was hoping my car would just fill up. Would I just leave it? And I thought, in 5 years' time, I'm going to be having those experiences, seeing people who might look like him, but knowing, well, actually, he is walking around. He is free. That actually could be him, you know. And I just feel I was going to spend my life looking over my shoulder. I've talked about, do I move to another country? I've looked at all sorts of countries, you know, sort of where can I go where I know that he wouldn't be necessarily let in. I can try and protect my child. It's all about protection of my children. You know, that's number one on my list is protecting, especially I've got three children, but the baby, the youngest one, not baby, she's seven, but is the one that is genetically his. I don't like to say his daughter because he lost that right. But I just think I've got to protect her. I've got to protect her. And I will spend my life, every living breath, protecting my children. Every living breath, protecting my children.
As mothers would do, Natalie, as mothers would do. I mean, where does it stand for you at this moment in time? Is there anything that you are able to contest with his parole? Do you have to go through a complete process, you know, to fight against him coming out?
Do you know, everything I was led to believe, and I might be wrong, is that you have that 6 week or something, you have this very short time frame after their sentence to appeal, and then that almost shuts. So as I think as a person who's committed the offence and their sentence, they can appeal at any point. But I think as the victim, I only have a very short time frame to actually appeal it. And how unfair is that for a start? How can you expect somebody who's so traumatised, who's literally physically, mentally exhausted, to say, oh, yeah, OK, yeah, I'm going to go through this in 6 weeks' time? And also, I've had so much more information come to light since that point. But I believe, and I might be completely wrong, that I can contest it. The only time I'll be able to have a voice, and I don't know how big that voice will be when it gets to his parole hearing, when they write a letter to me and they say, he's eligible for parole, he's going to have a parole meeting on this date, would you like to submit a statement? And I think they ask whether you'd like to be present, which, no surprise to anyone who knows me, obviously I want to be present. I think since COVID, a lot of this is done now online, on like a Zoom or a Teams meeting, but rather than in person. And again, I'm in a real rant now. When it comes to parole hearing, this is again where the justice system's crazy. He has the choice, okay, if he wants to stay in the room and listen to what I have to say as my victim impact statement about what it would mean to me with him being released. He has that choice whether he's there or not. Me as the victim, I do not have the choice to say, actually, I want him to step out for this moment so I can give my statement without him there, without that intimidation that he sat there staring at me. I have no choice. He has the choice to leave. I don't have the choice.
Seriously? Oh, my God. I genuinely didn't realise that. I mean, you'd think that you'd be protecting the victim and the emotional state of that victim, because obviously at the end of the day, let's not just use this as a... The amount of knife crime that goes on in this country is unbelievable, and Natalie will obviously touch on that and the amazing work that you're doing to try and, you know, prevent all of this. But the fact that it sounds like the system is for the actual perpetrators, the people that are, you know, causing and doing all of these, you know, no disrespect, and I say it, and he sounds like he's a psychopath. That's what I would say. You know, these are not actions of somebody that has temporarily, you know,
Temporary adjustment disorder, which isn't even...
like an absolute psychopath, in all fairness. So I just find it really shocking, Natalie, that you're having to go through all of this again and relive this again in a short period of time and still not guarantee that he's not going to be out walking the streets. Can I ask you, if he does get out, I presume he's not able to come anywhere near you, or is that right also sort of you understand?
So the reason I'm chuckling, there will be a restraining order in place, which means he will not be allowed within, I don't know, whatever a certain mile radius. Say for argument's sake, it's a 5 mile radius. So say if I have moved from the house that we lived in together and moved into a different property, but obviously wherever I live, I keep it very secret as to where I am. You know, I don't readily give out where I live. I haven't actually really moved particularly far, but if I decide to say move far away, say if I decided I'm going to move to a totally different part of England or move to Scotland or Wales, and they say to him, right, you can't go within 5 miles of this part of Cornwall, which is in the right in the southwest coast of England. Well, that then tells him where I live.
Yeah.
It's like you've just told him. So if I move to Cornwall to try and feel a bit safer, you've now told him. Equally, the other part of it is that there's no tracking of him, so it's not that he wears a tracker that could say, okay, he's gone into a zone within where she lives. It's only if somebody saw him, reported him, and the police acted upon it and found him within the area, would that be enforced? Now, let's take the scenario, my daughter is at secondary school at that point, so she's in the high school, and I wanted to get the bus with her friends, obviously. I wanted to be able to go to the shops with her friends when she's a teenager, just like my other two daughters do. I will eternally be scared that, well, what if he breaches that? He's shown he's capable of doing anything. He could breach that. He could turn up. He could sit outside her school. He could sit in the town centre, you know, and that's the horrific part of thinking, is the only way I'm safe is to leave the country. Is that going to be my only way to be safe, is to leave the country, leave my wider family, like my mum and my sisters, who are very close families, you know. So as a victim again, I'm the one who has to go through the upheaval. I'm the one who has to leave what I call home in order to keep my family safe, which I know, you know what, and it's not pity me, because, you know, there are plenty of people out there, and there are so many, majority women, I'll be honest, but there are men as well who've had to flee areas because of domestic abuse, because of domestic violence, who've had to set up homes. So I'm certainly not saying pity me, because this is not a pity me party at all. This is, there's lots of people who have to face this same situation where they have to uproot their lives to go and live and hide and be somewhere else. And it's just so wrong.
It just shocks me that, you know, like I said, it just seems to be that, you know, you as the victim and the person that's had to go through all the trauma of the attack and everything else, and you have no, your rights have been taken away from you with all of this. And, you know, he potentially, and I don't want to say this, but he could potentially be walking the streets. And then we have to think about, you know, other people. God forbid,
yep.
if he does this again, and this is,
yep.
You know, and people are going to probably come on here, and people that will probably turn around and say, well, you know, people can change, or this can happen, but really, seriously, are we willing to risk the fact that this could happen again to somebody else? You know,
there are some people who can change. You know, that's why I work with the young people that I do, who have committed offences, because, you know, and I work with some amazing people within officers within the prison service, and they said you have to hold that belief that people can change. But everyone will admit there are always certain cases that you look at it and go, but that particular person, could they really change? Because actually, either their pattern of thinking, their behaviours, what they actually committed, is that a set of circumstances that they got caught up in and led them to criminality, or is this somebody who has a different way of thinking, shall we say? Is it, you know, and when it's that, if it's so ingrained in somebody, I think there's a real concern there. You know, that's like saying a serial killer, oh, it's all right, just let them out and they'll be fine.
You've just taken the words out of my mouth. But again, I'll challenge this with anybody, because at the end of the day, you know, when you're dealing with young kids, which you are, you know, a gang crime, for example, when somebody stabs somebody, or if it's, you know, gangs fighting or whatever it may be, it's not the same as premeditating your partner and your unborn babies.
Yeah.
Murder. That is a different ball game altogether. You know, any knife crime is wrong. I'm not saying that it's all bad, full stop. However, I'm trying to differentiate, you know, premeditated attempted murder, and it could have been thank God it wasn't, but, you know, it could have been a lot worse, in the sense that you wouldn't be here today because of the of what he's done. Now,
we've got to think at the end of the day, my lovely, my heart stopped during theatre. They had to resuscitate me. They had to bring me back. I was very lucky that my heart didn't stop before I got to theatre. They thought, you know, the air ambulance helicopter thought that I was going to have a heart attack in the helicopter. They thought my heart was going to stop because my blood pressure was so low. So it's only because of medical science, because I happened to be in a place and we've got medical advances that meant they were able to shock me or do whatever they did, you know, to bring me back, that I'm alive. It's not because he wasn't successful insofar as he didn't, you know, he inflicted injuries and wounds on me that did kill me. I was resuscitated. Brilliant, obviously, because this would be a very strange program if I wasn't. But it was, so you're not talking with the dead today. But it is one of those things where he achieved what he set out to do. It's just medical science luckily brought me back and brought the little one back.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's crazy. It's crazy. They didn't treat it. They didn't sentence it the same as murder. It wasn't even brought up in court. You know, I've only just discovered recently because I have to have some further surgery soon. And it came up when they were assessing my safety for a general anaesthetic. And it was actually the surgeon who read the notes who said to me, "But you actually died." And I looked at him like, "Pardon? Excuse me?" Great way to break it to me. I actually wasn't aware that my heart did actually stop. And he went, "Yes." And he said, "Twice you died and they brought you back and you're too big a risk for us to give an anaesthetic to for this particular surgery you're having." And to know that he had been fully successful is because of medical science. I was brought back, yes, but why was he therefore not sentenced to reflect murder rather than just attempted murder, which could range, attempted murder could be a young kid has gone out, they've got a knife, but they're carrying a knife, which is wrong, completely wrong. I'm not defending it in any way. I work against knife crime continuously in my life, but
yeah.
Carries a knife, comes across someone, has a row, has an argument, knife gets pulled, uses it, injures somebody else. That person, through that one stab wound, can be done for attempted murder. That's very different to what Bob did. And yet they're not differentiated necessarily in sentencing.
Yeah. Wow. It just is. Oh, yeah, it does. I mean, it's exasperating, really, you know, when you because we live our daily lives and we all go out and we all live our daily lives, nobody knows what's going to happen, God forbid. You, at no point in your life, ever thought that your partner, the person that you were madly in love with, who you thought was in love with you, and was looking forward to having a beautiful baby, a new life, a wonderful home, you know, a great job. Your whole life, if anybody was looking in now, people would have turned around and said, "My God, they're the perfect couple." That's what they would have probably have said, because that's the life that you had. And then obviously it's just turned around in one split moment, and it's just shocking that, you know, that what you've had to go through and, you know, where you are now. But listen, I want to move on to, and I want us to talk about this amazing work that you're doing. But before we do that, I want to just touch on, again, for our international listeners, Natalie was awarded the MBE here in the UK, and it was by the Queen. And was it for her birthday? Was it for her birthday? Or was it?
Yeah.
For
the international listeners, there is an award system. That sounds like weird, but an award system. It's not like a reward chart. It's an award system here in the UK. And there's, you can be a British Empire Medal holder, a BEM. And then the next level up is an MBE, which is the Member of the British Empire, which is what I became. The next is an OBE, which is the Order of the British Empire. So that tends to be someone who runs a charity, for example. So it's somebody who's running an organisation, a big organisation generally. And then you have the CBE, which is just, I want to say Commander, I think, the British Empire. And that tends to be somebody who's given dedicated lifelong service. So it might be somebody who's given lifelong service to the armed forces, or sometimes people who are lifelong services to the entertainment industry. So it kind of goes in that order. And you have no idea that anyone nominates you. Apparently it's a very involved process. It's generally at least two people who have to nominate you. I had absolutely no idea that two people that I knew had gone through all of this process, and apparently there's all these forms that have to be filled out, and they have to have all these different pieces of evidence of the work that you've done, and they were getting testimonials from people that I've done work with, all behind my back. I had literally no idea. I know. And then for the Queen's birthday, so it's a royal award, and so it gets passed through this system. The Prime Minister gets this list. He then decides, are you worthy? And then he will put a rubber stamp on it, say, yep, she's passed or he's passed. That then goes to the Queen, or as it is now, the King. And then, so you've got the real proper head of state looking at it, and then they do the final sign off to say, yes, we feel that this person. So there's a lot of levels to get through. You're going through the most senior parts of our government, the most senior parts of our royalty, and the list gets announced for the new year. Is the one lot of awards, and then there's another lot of awards for the monarch's birthday. So for me, it was for the Queen's birthday last year.
Birthday, yeah. Oh, that's such an amount. Listen, I can see you with the OBE and the CBE now, with everything awarded. No, listen.
I have to get another hat. You have to wear a hat and everything, and you have to curtsy. And I did a little wobble when I curtsied. I was in really high heels, and I'm not used to wearing heels very often nowadays. I did my little curtsy, and I did a little wobble, and Princess Anne, Princess Royal, so the King's sister, gave me my medal. And I could see her with a little wry smile on her face, because I'm sure she saw me do my little wobble.
See, that's a great little thing. But you know what? The fact that you absolutely 100% deserve that, Natalie. I've known you for many years, and all I've ever known you do is think about others. And you are constantly raising money for charity. You are constantly doing, you know, things that I certainly would struggle to try and do. And I know recently doesn't matter for, you know, which charities, but you've raised so much money for the air ambulance, and obviously for charity, you know, generally. Talk a little bit about the work that you're currently doing, if that's okay, Natalie. I'd love, you know, for people to really have a full understanding about some of the amazing work. And then after that, I think I'd like us to talk about, you know, the domestic violence side of things, because I think we talked about that, didn't we, very briefly.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's start with the work, the wonderful work that you're currently doing. So give us an overview of that.
So I actually set up my own form of charitable organization, and it's a very small organization, which is focused purely to start with on knife crime. And I had no idea when I first got into all of sort of changing my world, leaving the pharmaceutical industry, which is a really scary thing to do because it's very well paid, it's got great healthcare insurance and pension and company car, and everyone thinks I'm bonkers to have said goodbye to healthcare and pension and everything else. But I was doing some corporate talks, basically. I was doing these corporate talks and empowering talks about resilience and everything else. And it was getting shared on the internet that I was doing these talks. And a small school contacted me. Now, this school is a specialist school where students who've got excluded permanently from mainstream education, so they're through behavioural acts generally, they've done things or that basically have led them to be kicked out of school permanently. And they said to me, Natalie, you're a speaker, you've been stabbed. Would you come and talk to our young people about what it's like to be a stab victim? And I'll be honest, if I sat there and I was like, whoa, I haven't really thought about that. I have no idea what these kids are going to think of me. I went to a grammar school, so I went to a single-sex girls' school, you know, just sort of education was all my way. And I thought, they're going to look at me, I'm a woman in my 40s, they're going to say, who's this middle-aged woman coming and talking to us about knife crime? I said, you know what? I'm going to give it a go. And so I put on my trainers and jeans and tried to look young, but quite sad, I know, but, you know, tried to pull it off. And went into this school, and I remember pulling up at the first one of these schools, and they have these big locked gates. It's a bit like a prison, big, high, really high security gates. And I thought, what am I doing? What am I doing? This is like a world away from the pharmaceutical industry and everything I know. And I walked in there really nervous, and there's a kid punching the wall and shouting, and fights were starting, and I was like, this is crazy. And I thought, right, keep breathing, keep calm. And I gave my talk, and I had these small different groups that came in, and I did four back to back. And I was a bit like with an hour plus with each of them, just over an hour with each. And I was exhausted, absolutely exhausted. But yeah, the response from the kids was amazing. I had these letters. They made me little pictures and poems, and just saying what impact it had, that I was really honest about, this is what it's like to be a stab victim, this is what you get left with, this is the physical side, this is the emotional side, because it said it made them think about it. And I thought, okay, didn't expect that bigger response. So I carried on doing them, and to cut a long story short, I now talk in schools and colleges and universities sometimes. I talk in a lot in those pupil referral units, these specialist units where kids have been excluded. But I don't just talk now just about the reality of knife crime. I do a lot of that. I work alongside the police force and give a lot of talks to them. But I now also talk to people like vulnerable young girls, and talking to them about, so these are girls who might have got exploited. They might have been groomed by somebody. They might have been sexually exploited, or they might be doing drug runs or something, to help them find their inner power, to not be held back by shame, to really say, it doesn't matter what dark time you've got through, come on, you can get through this. You can aim for better, you can focus on further. Start giving them that positivity, start giving those tools to cope better, different coping mechanisms, different tools for plan. So I do a lot of that work with vulnerable girls. My love and life passion, and what I really want to do, is open a trauma center for young people, because there's so many young people who are carrying around emotional trauma. So children who, especially children who've witnessed violence in the home, they've been victims of violence or neglect, or they might have witnessed violence in the street. You know, as you say, knife crime has increased. There's children who are witnessing things that we hate to think they witness. You know, think of our young people as well in the States, what they must witness with gun crime. It's just horrific. And these young people get very scared, and the trauma affects them, and it can then affect their behavior, and through no fault of their own, they react in a certain way can get them into trouble. So instead of us trying to deal with the end product of, okay, how do we sentence them, how do we deal with their bad behavior, why do we not try and deal with the root cause? Why do we not try to empower these young people? Why do we not try to help them overcome that trauma and realize the strength and resilience they've got? And that's my dream, because we have very little in the way of emotional trauma service here in the UK. So I'd love to open a trauma center, so all those kids I work with, to do, whether it's knife crime, whether it's to do with exploitation, whatever it is, to try and help them understand why they feel like they do potentially, or how they are reacting, and can we help them empower them, basically. So that's a lot of the work that I do. I do work a lot, as you said, in charities. I do a lot of fundraising for the air ambulance, but also for a children's hospice for children fighting things like cancer. I have recently got remarried, and my amazing, wonderful husband, his niece passed away when she was 11 from cancer, so the hospice that helped look after her, I do a lot of fundraising now for them. And another thing I do is I work alongside a domestic abuse charity. I'm an ambassador for the survivors, to help them see that there is a life past it, looking at how to change policies in workplaces, but be that voice around overcoming domestic abuse. And I sometimes talk to police professional services about, this is the journey I went on, this is what was good, this is what could have been better, and giving like almost sort of a inside feedback, and talk about victim blaming and language they might use as professionals for them to really think about how they're interacting, coming into contact with. So yeah, I have quite a varied life, it has to be said.
Honestly, the amount of I'm so proud of you as your friend. I am, and I see all of these amazing, and the amount of respect and love that you have from everybody around, you know, especially here in the area that we live, and, you know, everywhere, all over the UK. And you've had, you know, people from all over the world, in all fairness, that have, you know, followed your story, Natalie. You are so, so inspirational. You have been my inspiration. Things that I've seen, I've said this to you 1,000 times. There is just so much that you do, and you're so humble with it. And that's the most lovely thing about you, is that you are probably one of the most humble people that I know. And, you know, you're very selfless. Even through everything that you've gone, you don't want pity off people. You don't want people to feel. You just want to spread the love and also spread the word and try and help people. And that's one of the things that I will tell you as all the listeners out there that I know about that. Natalie, that, you know, she just wants to do good, and that is one of the most amazing things, especially after going through. Some people could become extremely what's the word I'm looking for, bitter, you know,
bitter.
And want to do anything, but what you have done is you've actually embraced you've embraced this, and you've actually turned it around, Natalie, into something positive. You are doing something positive for people out there and changing people's lives. So I just want to say well done for that. And,
thank
you know,
you.
I'm really proud of you. But, I mean,
I made myself broke in the process, probably, after leaving a very high salary to do it all. But it's about, I think everyone should always reflect on what you'd want to do. Because the one thing that I remembered, and I really want listeners to think about this, and don't go all leaving your job tomorrow, because that would be horrific, because you have still got bills to pay. However, reflect and think. I know that when I nearly died on that hill, and genuinely, obviously, it was very touch and go, I remember reflecting, thinking, although I was getting paid a lot of money, and everything else, I was away from my children a lot with the work and everything else, I thought, did I feel I was leaving the world in a place that I wanted? Did I feel I made the contribution that I wanted? Did it matter? Did the money matter? Now, of course, money matters in terms of paying bills, but I think it does make you really, really think about, we've got one life, we have one moment, we have one chance. And you know what? It's cheesy, we hear it all the time, but when you've been there, it really, I can totally testify that you must always look within your own values and think about, am I doing everything? Is it that I might do some bit of volunteering? Might I do something else? But what is it that's your value? What's your value? And are you living it? Are you being true to yourself? And I wasn't, so that's why I had to change.
You know what, though, Natalie? I mean, like I said, the things that you have done, and you've only touched on a snippet. It's the tip of the iceberg. Let's be real here. You've literally given us the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
It is so unbelievably inspiring, and the amount of messages that I have had since Saturday's show, Natalie, from people on social media and contacting me to say what an amazing and inspirational woman that you are, and what an amazing show that we had. And it just, I want to shine a light on all of these things. And, you know, what really surprised me, and to be honest with you, I never thought about it, Natalie, but you're so right. When we talked about, we went out for dinner, just to let you know, guys, we all went out for dinner, didn't we? We ended up, well, I ended up like a blubbery mess, in all fairness, but we were talking about your circumstances, and you mentioned about, like, the domestic violence, and I never in a million years turned it into the point that, you know, he was being mentally he was abusive to you, but you didn't realize that at that time. So I'm really sort of, say it in your own words, Natalie, because the way that you'd explained it to me at that point in time, it really made me think. So yeah, I mean, go ahead.
By the way, to all the listeners, the reason I chuckled at that point is that Sophia and I ordered far too much food, and we sat there with all these bowls of food around us, hardly touching it, sitting there crying and holding hands. So everyone was like staring, thinking, who are those two ladies who clearly have a good appetite and are just sitting there now crying over the bowls? Have they ordered so much food it has upset them? I'm not quite sure what everyone thought of us in the restaurant, but that aside, so yes, back to Bobby. It came out that literally from the moment we got together again as adults, I'd known him through my teenage years. We'd lost the direct contact, but my best friend from school was married to his best friend, so my wider circle stayed together. So I knew of what he was doing, and he still was this kind man, and everyone loved him and everything else. And we get together later in life through the wonders of social media, through Facebook, and connect and go out for a drink. That moment, even of us going out for a drink, and probably the things that he was telling me from that first date and the intensity of the relationship and everything else, there were so many lies that he said. There was so much that he created a persona, which I think he'd spent his life doing, that whoever he met, if he met you, Sophia, he'd tell you one story. If he met, obviously, me, he'd be telling a different story. Someone else, he might tell a different story. But whoever he met, he would tell a version of the story that would make him seem the best to that person that he was telling it to. And it was devastating to learn, because I really struggled with the whole type of domestic abuse. And I was just like, I had magazines here in the UK who kept contacting me, the big glossy magazine, saying, Natalie, we're doing a piece about domestic abuse. We want to feature your story. And I was like, whoa, no, what are you talking about? Like, really horrified. Like, what are you talking about? And then it took 4 years of denial for me to then turn around and meet a very wonderful lady called Lucy Whittaker, who runs this domestic abuse not-for-profit company that I work an ambassador for now. And Lucy turned to me and she said, but you were, Natalie. And I was like, well, I know he tried to kill me and blah, blah, blah. So she said, no, but all the lies, all the manipulation. And she said that was coercive control. He made you believe a certain way of life. And when you question things, he almost made you feel like you were going mad.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, yeah, he did. And then the penny starts to drop, because domestic abuse is so complex. We all think it's the person with the black eye, you know, and that happens, and that's horrific, absolutely horrific. I've seen it firsthand with people, a woman, you know, in that case it was a woman, but I've also seen it with men with injuries who have been beaten by their partners. That is horrific, but that is what our brain tends to go to, generally speaking. I'm speaking very generally here, don't want to offend anybody, but generally speaking. And I am guilty of that as the next person, because really the complexity of domestic abuse and the whole coercive control, as we call it, that manipulation, that where somebody will tell you a story and then if you question it, they'll almost make you feel like you're the bad person. Why are you questioning me? I would not, you know. And that had gone on really for the whole of our relationship. And it was only when he realized that his lies were not going to stand up anymore, and that in fact everything was unraveling, I feel that is the point where he resorted to murder, that he thought lie he couldn't cover up. He covered up so many, everything, even down to the car that he drove didn't even belong to him. It was absolutely crazy. And I was absolutely shocked, and this is the big thing to remember. I worked in an industry where you know, your brain had to be switched on, you're constantly thinking, but also I was brought in to sit on a lot of interview panels. So these are senior leaders in the pharmaceutical industry saying, Natalie, can you sit in? You're a great judge of character. You pick up things really quickly. So here am I, this person who's been known for this, good judge of character. Hold on, I've just been manipulated for the last year and a half, 2 years by this man. What the hell? How the hell did that happen? And it just goes to show, it doesn't matter who you are, what your background is, how clever you are, what your job is, anything. If somebody wants to manipulate you, you can still fall victim. It's not your fault. It is all about that person. And they can be very, very clever people. And it's to get away from this victim blaming, to get away from this stigma, for people to stand up and say, do you know what, that has happened to me, or that is happening to me. I need help. I need support. I am not going to be stuck in this shame. I am not going to be stuck in this stigma. Because there's so many men and women who get caught in such a stigma that they feel, I can't say that somebody's done this to me because I'm going to look weak, I'm going to look like I'm a bit stupid, or it's my fault in some ways. And things might get said to them like they've got said to me. You know, people said to me, well, surely you saw some signs. How did you miss that? How did you not question that? And I went, you weren't living my life. You don't know what I was being told. And actually I did question some things, and then I'd get a response. But people are very quick to judge, and that can therefore be very damaging for people to want to come forward. But we've got to break the stigma around domestic abuse. We have to be able to talk about it. We have to see that there are people in very senior positions in life who are victims, just as somebody who isn't in such a senior position, and everybody is an equal victim. You know,
yeah,
no person is a lesser victim than another. Everybody is a victim, and they are a victim of somebody else's behaviour. It's the perpetrator who's done it. They are the person at fault, not the victim. This is not the victim's fault.
It's narcissistic. It's narcissistic behaviour as well. Obviously, controlling and narcissistic behaviour. And there's so many of us, including myself, you know, that have been in relationships that have been toxic, completely and utterly toxic and narcissistic. And, you know, this is to the extreme where, you know, Bobby was, oh my goodness, the thing is that I still can't wrap around, in my brain, Nat, is that how long had he been pre-planning this to a certain extent? Did you ever find out? And can I ask you, I mean, these are really direct questions, and I don't think I've ever asked you this, but I'm
holding my breath now, so go on.
No, one, do you hate him or do you forgive him? This is what I'm trying to, you know, there's two,
okay.
Because you have to, yeah, I'm going to ask the question straight out. How do you feel about Bobby? Do you hate him? And have you forgiven him for what he's done?
Right. Okay. This opens up a whole can of worms, my lovely. Because there is a big international movement called the Forgiveness Project, and I have some dear friends who are very much part of that, and they have gone on their own journey of forgiveness. And I've challenged it at times, I'll be totally honest. So starting with the do I hate him? No, insofar as I'm disgusted by him.
Okay.
I think that's a better word than hate. The problem with the word hate is that it creates a very negative energy within the person who's doing the hating. And there's a lot of literature about the fact that negative energy will eat you up. That's when you talk about the being bitter. It creates a destruction within the person. And that's really sad because there are a lot of victims who understandably hate their perpetrator. I feel utter disgust. Actually, in a way, you feel sorry for him just going, do you know what? It's disgusting. It's disgusting what you've done. So it's actually probably disgust and disdain. It's just like, no, you know, absolutely disgusted with what you've done. And I think that's more of a, some people might say, is that still hate? I don't see it as the same as hate, because I think hate is that, I've seen hate in action with people, and that channel such negative energy. On the forgiveness side, very interesting one. I'm going to be really honest, okay? This is being really, really honest.
Yeah, I'm asking the question because I've never asked
no,
you this.
No, I will never forgive him. I will never forgive him. And I know many people who've talked to me about this who said, you know, oh gosh, crikey. This is a big thing on the internet actually the other day on Instagram. And there's a post by Russell Brand, who very well known, and he's talking about this whole thing with forgiveness. And I've read the feed, and yeah, that's for my own mental safety, I came off it. And just because he wasn't saying it either way, by the way, this is nothing against Russell Brand at all. He just put the question out there about forgiveness. And I was just reading the comments, which can be a dangerous place to go in any part of social media. But I was reading this, and so people sort of going, saying, if you do not forgive, there's something wrong with you. Pardon? And he's like, hold on, so you're kind of trying to say that if a victim doesn't forgive, so I have to forgive him in order to be truly released. No. Utter, I won't say that word because it's really naughty, utter nonsense. It's utter bullshit. It is utter bullshit because it just annoys me. It's nothing to do with, I have to forgive him. If I forgave him, that would just me be lying. I don't forgive him. How could I forgive him? He tried to take my children's mom away. So he's prepared to leave my two girls who were 10 and 6 without their mom. He kissed them goodbye that day, yet they were going to grow up without their mother. He was prepared to kill my baby and very nearly did. what he did was unforgivable, and he's caused a lot of lifelong damage for all three of my children in different ways. And when it's not even about me, about it's not about forgiving him for what he did to me. It's about I can never forgive what he did to my children, and that's what I could never forgive. And so therefore, I'm just really honest and just go, no. And that's not me being bitter or caught up. That's just me being honest. It's like, no, because what he did to my children, it's just unforgivable.
No, I'm so pleased being honest and sort of truthful. And I mean, I hope you don't mind me asking that question.
No,
because
no.
And you know where you are with it. Because believe me, if I were in your shoes, I don't think I could ever forgive anybody like you. I don't think I could. You know, when you know what they've actually wanted, what they wanted to do, and they nearly succeeded. Listen,
yep.
I've said a thousand times, divine intervention, Natalie. People are stabbed once and they die.
Mm-hmm.
You were
yep.
stabbed with a 12-inch carving knife 24 times. The baby was missed by 2 millimeters. And I'm reiterating this, Natalie, for people that
yep.
didn't listen to the show on Saturday, because what I'm saying is that this woman is on this earth for a reason. God has kept her here for a reason. You have a path that you are going down, Natalie, and I've said this to you. You know, I know that you are here to spread the good, the love, the understanding and everything that you've experienced to others to make a difference. To make a difference to people here. And I just want to say thank you for doing that, because without people like you doing this, we would still live in a society potentially that could just literally get worse and worse and worse. And, you know, you are doing such amazing work in, you know, prisons. And I think your work, can I just say, Natalie, shouldn't just be left to the UK. I actually think we should be having you, and your story should be, worldwide, especially in America, where there is so much. I don't know whether you're aware, but this is slightly different, but gun crime and knife crime, obviously, in the States as well, is very, 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 very rife. And I was talking to Greg about this, and we were talking about the whole, you know, ins and outs. And Greg and I, as you know, I think I'm explained to you, we were fortunate enough to have a role to play in a movie, which is actually due out, which is called When, and it's due out in August, and that was specifically on gun crime. But your work, the work that you do, Natalie, I can see this going all over the world. I don't think you should just be doing it in the UK. I think this is something that you would be able to spread all over the world. And if there's any way that we can actually help to get that message across, then, you know, Greg and I would be absolutely ecstatic to try and help to do that. And I think your story, again, I'm gonna reiterate this, I said it on Saturday, and I'm sorry I'm talking a lot here, but I just really need to get this out. You need to have this produced into a drama. I can see your story on a, and I'm sure there's going to be, you know, listeners out there that will be messaging in, and I'd be intrigued to know, you know, if you agree, actually, everybody, but I think, a drama on Netflix or with HBO or some of the big, you know, producers, a movie of some sort, I think this would be an amazing story with a great message for people to show, you know, how you can overcome even the worst, the worst scenarios and worst things that happen in your life. You are just an inspiration, Natalie, and I want to help do whatever we can to spread your story around the world. But yeah, I mean, I think
when I wrote Still Standing, so when I wrote my book Still Standing, that was with the purpose and intention for people to understand the truth, because as you can imagine, the media went crazy. And so when I first wrote the book, it was kind of, I started to make notes about the journey, what was happening, what was coming out, all the lies. And I wrote my book Standing, which takes you right from before the attack. You can go through how the relationship developed, and it, because I wrote it so soon after, I started writing it in 2017, so the year after. It got published in 2019, about 2 years to write. I wrote it all myself. I got a great publisher, which obviously was through yourself, Sophia, that connection and connectivity. But when I wrote the book, it was purely for people to understand the truth of the journey. So it ends with the day I faced him in prison. It's my first ever time of ever walking into a prison. It was a very surreal experience. I spent the whole day in the prison, and I wanted people to understand that journey, understand what it was like in the court, understanding what I found out, how you said the rebuild, the resilience, the having to fight those dark thoughts, you know, about I've got to keep going, I've got to put one foot in front of the other. And what I haven't realised, that my book's still standing, although it's not in America, I'd love to get it out in America. It has gone to Australia. Well, it's gone to Australia, it's gone to New Zealand, it's gone to United Arab Emirates, it's gone to South Africa, it's been translated to Estonian. So it has gone across
the world
in one direction, Singapore as well, I believe. But the response has been huge, and the response is very much about people going, wow, that's really made me think, you know, because it's not a typical story when it comes out about the complexity. There's so many issues that come out, you know, sort of two different cultures coming together, the whole lying, the manipulation, but living in this seemingly perfect bubble world, you know, but then everything unfolding and everything falling apart and then rebuilding it back together. So I've had it as a goal, and it's so sweet of you to bring it up, because you know it's a real goal of mine to have it produced in some way.
There's
so many things to talk about within that. I think there's some really key important parts that can be, and then everyone can find out what I did. Then again, if you read the book, you'll know. And there's a little funny anecdote in that. Whether we'd include that in any film production, I'm not sure, because obviously my mother would have to watch it. But yeah, there was a bit of a funny anecdote to do with something that I'd packed up in his stuff that I returned to his mother's house. But yeah, there's a lot in there. There's going to be humour within it as well, because I've got a terrible sense of humour. But I just think it's a really important topic to bring.
You crack me up, Nat. You actually crack me up, because, you know, we could be talking about something so in-depth and serious, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'll tell you one of the things, and I think we touched on it on Saturday, Natalie. I remember you saying, and we were sitting there having dinner, when we were having dinner, and she went, Sophia, you'd just been stabbed 24 times, and they were trying to save your life, yeah? And they get you on the helicopter, and you turn around to me, and you turn around and you said, Sophia, I could just remember lying there thinking, oh, my God, I hate flying.
I do. I remember thinking as we took off, I thought, I don't like flying. And like that, I had no other choice, no other transport, really. And, you know, and I was about to die, so it really wasn't the time to be telling him that. But, and also, you know, it is those funny little things that come into your head. They were trying to get a line into me in the ambulance, because they have to, you know, they're trying to get blood and fluids into me, because I was losing them so rapidly, and they kept saying, and bless them, in, I don't know if it's the same in America but or across the world, but they always say in the UK, sharp scratch, when they're about to give an injection or try and get a needle into it, sharp scratch. And this poor paramedic, he tried about, I can't remember, probably 10 times, and the guy kept saying, Natalie, sharp scratch, sharp scratch. And in the open eyes, I went, mate, I've just been stabbed lots of times, you really don't need to keep saying sharp scratch, it's fine, just get it in, don't worry. And he kind of looked at me and went, what? I just smiled and shut my eyes again. It's just like, it's all right, mate. Fine. Stop saying sharp scratch. It's cool. I've just been stabbed. You don't need to say that. Really? It doesn't matter.
And the other thing, the other one, I think, you cracked me up again. I remember they had to get some fluids down, you know, if I'm correct. And you turn around and you said, I don't drink. Is it sugar or is it Diet Coke or something of that nature?
Well, they wanted to go and get. They got a drink for me. They went to McDonald's and they said, and they came back and they went, Natalie, we have this Coke for you. And I went, oh, is it diet? Because I don't drink full fat. And they looked at me and went, just drink it, Natalie. Just drink the drink. You're like, please. I was like, okay. I mean, I think that's dedication to the cause of my figure. To be fair, you know, I was thinking about it conscientiously right up to the very end. But, you know.
What amazing figure. Absolutely. And can I, Nat, am I allowed to bring up the, you know, the stabbing in the chest and what stopped it? Are we allowed to talk about that? I'm not going to, it's a quick, but
Yes, you can talk about that. That's absolutely fine. Do not worry. I actually had to have a scan this week, and I brought it very openly with the because I had to have a MRI scan of my pancreas. They had to do some follow-up checkups, and the lady did have to say to me, Nasty, you're not wearing a bra or anything. And I did actually say to her, no, don't worry, they're not real. They stay up there. There is no bra holding them. And that is part of what saved me, was the fact that I had breast enhancement surgery, crikey, not long before I met Bobby, because I'd had two children. And ladies who are listening to this will understand that you breastfeed your child, which is tell you it's the best thing obviously for your child, but it leaves you not in a great way necessarily afterwards. And I'd lost weight, bought and rushing around with two children. So I was quite self-conscious of my figure. So it was really the fact that I was very, very flat-chested. I had quite short, dark hair. I felt a bit too boyish. I wanted to feel a little bit more feminine. So it was for me. I had breast enhancement surgery. Now, the sweet irony was that I had to have those implants changed whilst I was with Bobby. Now, when he came to the surgeon with me for the appointment, I was going, should I go very slightly bigger? And he goes, yeah, go for that next size up. And I had a round implant, as they call it, with different shapes. The knife went through my chest multiple times. It shredded the implants that I had in there. However, it came out afterwards. The knife had gone through the outer part of my heart. Had I not had my implant and it be the size that it did, it slowed the knife down because it's quite a hard, tough bag, as it should be. And it slowed the knife down. And they said, if you hadn't actually had that implant, and if I hadn't actually had it swapped to the implant that I had, Bobby shot himself in the foot. So he wanted his partner to have large breasts. And actually, that's probably what thwarted his plans at the time, was because actually those implants slowed the knife down. So there's a nice bittersweet irony that makes me smile about that. And so, yes, I had to have them removed because they'd been shredded. It wasn't very good, great, but they did actually, but a terrible headline, even on good quality newspapers here in the UK, they did actually at one point, and I was like, oh God, that's so embarrassing. It did actually have on the headline, breast implants save woman's life. I was like, well, not technically just the breast implants, but going to be the thing that sells the newspapers. That's fine. But yeah, after a year of having them out, I have had them returned. I'm very proud to say that, because my chest is so scarred. Well, they are there. They saved my life, and you know they are what they are, and they are part of me, really. They are called Daphne and Keith because it was my auntie Daphne's money when she passed away, that and her husband Keith, they passed away, beautiful couple, and it's the inheritance money from them that paid for them, so they are called Daphne and Keith, and I'm very proud of them.
Oh, I love it. So left is Daphne, right is Keith.
I'd say so, yeah. I always think that's quite a nice little side behind to put on. Nobody else probably, people can name their cars, people don't usually name their breast implants, but hey, I'm not a normal person, I guess, so that's fine.
Oh, bless you.
But that's probably more information than anyone listening needed to hear, so apologies to the listeners.
No, do you know what? I think, you know, the fact that we can actually sort of talk about this, it's such a serious topic and conversation. And I think sometimes if you can't look at things now and actually try and find something positive about the experience that you've gone through, and these little antidotes are the things that actually, this is you, Natalie. Everything that we're talking about here, these little quirky things, that is Natalie Kairos. That is the Natalie Kairos that I know and love. And, you know, even in your deepest, you know, deepest, darkest moments, you still, you know, tried to, I don't think you actually meant to be funny, but the fact that you tried to, you know, honestly, anybody that meets this woman, I'm lost for words. I don't know why, but I'm lost for words. You're just one of the most amazing people and women that I know. You are just one of the most beautiful, kindest souls that walks this planet. And all I want is the best for you. And I pray and hope that all your dreams do come true. And, you know, I know that one of your dreams is to make your book into either a TV series or a drama or a movie, and as much as I can possibly help you to get your story out, Greg and I will definitely do whatever we can to try and to move that forward for you, because it deserves to be heard, and I think your story can make a huge difference to millions of people around the world. I really do. You're an inspiration, Natalie, and I just want to say you are absolutely amazing. So how are the children at this moment in time? How are they coping with everything at the moment? Have they been able to sort of put this behind them to a certain extent?
It's a bizarre one, because trauma is a weird thing. I read a quote once. I do a lot of reading and research, because I think it's really good, especially the area that I go into, what I do, working with young people as I do. I'm always wanting to understand more and learn more, and I became a specialist qualified working with gangs and with youth violence, because I knew that I didn't understand that world. So similarly with trauma, I wanted to understand it for my work, and also for my own kids, to understand what was going on for them. And there's so much out there. There's some amazing people, some amazing specialists actually who are based in America who I hold very dear. And there's an amazing book as well that Oprah Winfrey did with a psychological Bruce Perry, an incredible book if anyone ever reads it, called What Happened to You, which really shows how trauma can affect young people for such a long time. And there can be times where I can look at the kids and you think, we're going through a positive patch, but then there's triggers, and there's always going to be triggers of small things. So if I go away, my middle daughter, who was only 6 and a half at the time, she gets really anxious, if I am not in contact for whatever reason. So I went down, I was in London at a meeting, and I was giving a talk, and I'd got my phone on silent because I was giving a talk down in London, and I hadn't noticed that she'd messaged me. And when I looked at my phone later that night, she'd messaged me about 19 times, and she was desperately worried that, are you okay, Mum? Why aren't you responding? And my heart broke just to think I'm a grown woman, I hate to say that I'm 47, but I am 47 now, and yet I have my daughter who's 13, and she's worrying about me as if I'm the child, because you can see how that trauma, that, hold on, Mum's not contacted us back, what if something bad's happened to Mum? And you can see that trauma still affecting. And the great quote that I read, which I just alluded to before, was that it sort of said how trauma permanently changes us. There's no getting over it. We don't get over it, and I think anyone would understand this, if you've had a big loss, a personal loss, a grievance, you've lost a relative or something, somebody close to you. You don't get over a trauma, but we learn to live with it. We have to embrace it. There's a new you, and I think myself and the children, we've had to embrace there is a new us. We will never be the people we were the day before the attack, even that morning of the attack. However, that doesn't have to be a negative thing. And I think that's what I always try to remind the children, is that we have these things that set us off, that can all make us feel a little bit edgy or a little bit unnerved. But actually, let's look at the positive side of who we are and what we've got through, and embrace that strength. And that's what I'm always trying to remind them, that they are incredible. I know I'm really, really biased. Of course, they're my kids, And don't get me wrong, they can be a pain in the ass at time as well, because they're kids. But they are my absolute life, and they have been affected. They will always be affected. I'm sure it will play in their minds, I'm sure, in their relationships later in life, But it's always getting them to talk. They've had psychologists. They might need further psychologists at certain points, but I don't think that you ever have one psychological intervention and then that's it for life. There's times where you have to revisit that as you process things differently, but they are amazing. But you can definitely see the effects, and I think that's true. And that's true with the young people that I work with. I can see trauma coming out in different ways, and I think it's just that understanding of that. And yeah, I can sort of see that. It doesn't make it any easier to deal with, by the way. I say all of this as if it's really easy. It's fine. It's really not easy to deal with. It can be frustrating. It can be heartbreaking. It can be all of those things, but ultimately it's always going back to, this has changed us. We can't do anything about it. The act has happened. There's a brilliant psychologist called Gabor Maté, which I'm sure lots of your listeners have heard of, Gabor Maté. And Gabor Maté, you know, he talks about trauma and the fact that trauma is not what happens to us. It's actually what happens inside of us. And that's really important, because actually if the trauma was just about what Bob did that day, we can't change that. It's an act. You know, if we lost somebody, we can't change it. It's an act. It's happened. Trauma is what's inside. So trauma is how we react to that. But we can control that, because that's within us. So we can't overcome it, but we can learn to live with it, work with it, play to its strengths, learn to understand the negative impact, and therefore it gives us hope. And that's what I'm always trying to say to the kids. There is hope. There is hope that, yes, we can't change what happened, because trauma is about what happens inside of us, but we can understand it and we can use it to its best potential. So, yeah. Oh. Sorry, I'm on my soapbox again.
No. Oh, my goodness. This is what I love, Natalie. You are so inspirational. You carry on. And one of the things I just wanted to touch on is that, you know, there has been such an amazing happy ending. And I know you touched on it earlier, but you recently, has it been about 12 months now? You got married.
Last October.
To one of the most beautiful, beautiful men. And you have had, oh, my goodness, just from one thing, obviously, with Bobby, but you found love. You've actually found true love, my love.
Yes.
Tell us all about your story there and how you met. And
it's
really great for people to see that there is always a silver lining, even from adversity. There is always a silver lining. And
I met Simon. Crikey, I met Simon in. Well, I first came across Simon's family, which sounds really weird, but I'll explain it in a minute. In 2018, so this was 2 years after it all, and I was doing a fundraising event for the air ambulance, and I decided that year I was going to do this 8.5 mile run in the heat in one of their flight suits, which are quite heavy, so if you know what they're like, they're quite bulky. I had to wear long trousers underneath it, like Lycra trousers, because they rub. I had to wear a t-shirt. So everyone else in this run was wearing shorts and t-shirts, and they're sweating. I'm not only in long trousers and a t-shirt, but I've got this flight suit over the top, and I'm running 8.5 miles up and down hills in the heat. And so I am starting this run off. They asked me, Natalie, will you start the run off? Will you do a bit on the mic and set everyone off, and then you can join in? It's not a race, so it's just a run. So I did that, and I learnt that in the crowd was Simon's family, because they were raising money for Simon's niece, who was battling cancer at the time. They were trying to get money to get her to America for this new treatment. She was quite advanced with the cancer that she'd got. And they did raise some money, but unfortunately she was too ill to travel when they got the money. And she has since passed away, absolutely heartbreakingly. So I gave a shout out on the microphone to Simon's family and to his niece Isabella, who was actually being pushed in a wheelchair in the race. And Simon's brother Mark, Isabella's dad, got hold of me, and Isabella's dad Mark said, thank you so much, it meant a lot to Isabella that you talked about it on the mic. I said, absolutely no worries. And we became great friends, Mark and myself. And then I turned up on the New Year's Eve to drop a card off, because Mark and Isabella were both poorly, to drop a card off for them on New Year's Eve of 2018. And I knock on the door and Simon opens the door, and I thought, oh, he's nice. But I was really wary, and time went on. And then in the May of 2019, so this is just after the 3 year mark, I've been having 3 years of therapy with a therapist who my psychologist I've talked about before. She's amazing. She got me in a place of self-worth and self-belief. And Simon and I went on a date in May. In fact, it was your ticket, Sophia, that Simon had. It was for a charity event, and you were unable to go. And you said, here you are. Take that man, Simon, that you've talked about. Okay. Take him in my place. He had your ticket. And he came to a really romantic charity boxing night, not exactly your usual venue for a romantic first date. And it was just lovely. And it took a lot of time to sort of build that trust together because of what happened, because obviously Bobby'd seem lovely. But Simon and I obviously got married last October, so we've been together about, 4.5 years now, and married, about 9 months. And he's amazing. He's lovely. And it's a lot more of a real relationship, as in Bobby and I never used to argue. You know, obviously Simon and I, we still have our little bits of, like, a normal sort of, like, can annoy each other, but I love the bones of him, and I would like to say that he thinks the same. I know, but he's amazing. He's a lovely, lovely man, and I never needed to get remarried. And I always said this to people: I never needed to find another partner to have, you know, I believe happy endings are about how my life's developed full stop, and it's still developing. But Simon was a key part, and the one thing I was really part of that happiness, the one thing I was really adamant about was that Bobby was not going to finish my life. Bobby's outlook would be that I would never find anyone again, and he wasn't going to have that control. You know, if I didn't find anyone again, I locked myself away, sat there bitter, I'm never being with anyone again, blah, 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 men are evil, go away. He would have won, and he wasn't going to win. And, I embrace it. And so, yeah, I am married. And did a charity walk recently in my wedding dress, just to add it all.
I know. You can add that to a list of other charitable events that you've actually done. But hitting on what you say, I'm in exactly the same mindset as you, Natalie, because, you know, obviously, you know, I've been through some really difficult times and years, and you don't look for anything and you don't want. However, you know, people come into your life unexpectedly, and they come into your life, whether as friends or as, you know, as colleagues or whatever it may be. But I have, you know, and I'm going to say it out loud, and I really don't mind anybody listening to this, but I have had so much support over the last, 12 months by my producer, Greg. I love him to bits. I absolutely love him to bits. He has been there for me in the difficult times and the great times. He's opened doors that I would never have ever dreamt I would have been able to open, you know, from going. And it's really, like you say, it's a different ball game altogether, isn't it, Natalie? When you're dealing with people that really understand you, you know, you found somebody that absolutely loves the doors.
Can I say, thank you.
Oh, hello.
Hello. Thank you. I'm just listening to that. Okay, I didn't mean to interrupt, but that made me weep. I'm weeping. Thank you, Sophia.
Aww.
Thank you. Carry on, guys. I apologize. Carry on.
You know,
I forget
what?
He's listening. I forget that he's there. Crikey.
You know, he's my manager. He's my producer, and he's my confidant. I absolutely adore this man. He's the best thing that has come into my life over the last, you know, over the last 12 months. He has helped me and listened to me, you know, in good times and in bad. And, you know, we are doing some amazing things. We have written the most amazing book, Natalie, and I hope you don't mind. I just want to sort of give a big shout out to everybody out there. We have sold thousands, thousands of pre-sale books.
Amazing.
And we are helping charity as well. So I need to make sure that I have a shout out for Natalie. You don't know this, but you know, it's a shout out for Monica Shafak. Unfortunately, she's not very well at the moment. She had a bit of a fall and is in hospital at the moment. And I just want to say a big shout out to Monica. But all of the proceeds that we get, that we, you know, from profits, we're going to be given a percentage to the Kaleidoscope charity, which is obviously the mental health charity. So every book that we sell is going to actually go out and try and help, you know, other people, because it's something that we need. You know, I have been blessed with the opportunity with Greg in my life to be able to, you know, do this. You know, I wouldn't have been able to write this book and get it published if it wasn't for Greg. So I owe him so much. And I just want to say a big thank you. And this is not about anything else from that perspective. But the book is actually out for sale at this moment in time. And if anybody wants to pre-order a copy, it's called Emma's European Adventure. And you can get it at www.emmasfabulousadventures.com. You can go onto the website and actually order your copy. But I hope you don't mind me just sort of bringing that up because...
Absolutely not. Absolutely.
People surround you, Natalie, that bring the best out in you, that actually believe in you. It's amazing what we can achieve, and I do believe that. And whether they are friends, business partners, you know, like me and Greg, and, you know, or whatever it may be, you find those special people, you hold on to them, you grab them, you hold on to them, and you never let them go. And so, Greg, thank you. For everything. I've said it on air in front of millions of people, so thank you for everything that you've done.
Oh, I feel like a gooseberry now. I'm glad there's millions of people listening because you can all be with me. But no, I totally agree. I think it's a really key thing to know. I remember my psychologist saying to me after what happened, she said, because friendships did change, my friendships, and you know this, Sophia, that some of my friendships have changed, and because you do find yourself, you do really reflect on not to say who's there, but you sort of really realise who's there, who nourishes your soul, and you nourish them, conversely, you know, equally, it's a two-way thing, and you develop the most amazing friendships, and that can also come out of very challenging times, is that you'll really look at the people around you and you'll embrace that and you'll love it even more. But everyone listening, think about who's around you and always nurture and bring in the people. You don't have to be many people at all. It can be a very small circle of those people who really you feel they nourish me, they, you know, they feed my soul, they make me feel good, they make me feel like I can achieve or be whatever, they're my cheerleader. And move away from those toxic people. Don't be around toxic people just because you feel you owe them or because, you know, you've always known them, that I've been friends with them since college years or whatever else. You know, move away from those toxic people. Don't be afraid. It's not being nasty. It's not being horrible. It's about nourishing your soul, and nourishing your soul will lead to growth, and that growth will just propel you in all sorts of directions. And I know that, you know, with my friendship with yourself, Sophia, and, you know, there's people that I've met on my journey that I know that they have done that for me. And there's things that I'm doing now that are just crazy and I'm loving it, and there's so much more ahead. But look at who's around you, and, yeah, go with those who nourish you.
Absolutely 100% agree with you, Natalie. And I think, like we say, sometimes we don't appreciate the people that we do have around us. And, you know, I have to give a big shout out, like I said, to Greg, but also, you know, my big sister, Joanna. Mm-hmm. You know Joanna, Natalie.
Yep.
She was my rock through the most difficult time in my life. And, you know, I will be eternally indebted to her and to Steve, my brother-in-law, my mom and everybody else. And I don't want this to be a thank you to everybody, but we have to embrace the people that support us because they bring out the best in us. They're the ones that actually believe in us, that make us aspire to get our dreams and to do. I've wanted to do this all my life. I've wanted to do, you know, Natalie, you know what what I've always aspired to do. And I'm living the dream now. I'm actually living the dream. I'm able to do that, you know. What I'm saying, and what if I can leave this on a positive note for everybody, you know, never give up. Never give up on anything that you dream about, because you can achieve it through adversity. Look at Natalie. She's the perfect example of how you can overcome the worst adversity. Unbelievable. She is the most inspirational person that I know. So I just want to say, first and foremost, Natalie, because we're going to, you know, we're going to go on a short break and have some music playing. But I just want to say a huge thank you for agreeing to come on the show and sharing your story with us. And, I just want to say a huge thank you, Natalie, for doing that. And we are, going to go to some music and enjoy the rest of the, everybody enjoy the rest of your evening. But Natalie, last words to you.
My last words are, as you say, reflect on who nourishes you and nourish your own soul. Look after yourself. Do the things that make you feel good and never stop learning. That's the other thing. Never stop learning. Whatever interests you, learn more, grow your mind, grow your soul, grow the people around you, and anything is possible. Anything.
Thank you, Natalie. You've been listening to Sophia and Natalie here on the Ask Sophia Show on G Radio. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in this evening. I hope you found it insightful. Good night, and thank you again.
feel defeated, falling on your knees and looking up for some hope tonight. You try to stand up, but you throw your hands up, like you no longer have the strength to fight. Cause you've seen too many sunsets, too many days ending in the darkest night. But on your own, you'll never know, you'll never know. If you believe you can move the highest mountain, cross the greatest. All you need is faith, but it's almost like you lost your way. Took a few wrong turns, took a few breaks, falling behind now looking for grace. Cause you need someone to lift you up, yeah, make right of the things you've done. Cause on your own you'll never know, you'll never know.